Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
The Republican National Convention wrapped up last night as Donald Trump accepted his party's nomination for president. And the day after taking the stage at the RNC, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio is in court this afternoon. KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Blanc was in Cleveland for the RNC. She got back to Phoenix this morning and is with Arpaio in court today. I spoke with her earlier and asked her about how the Arizona delegation responded to Donald Trump's speech.
Well, it was really interesting. I talked to a few people who had not been big Trump fans, but they came out of the arena on Thursday night being fired up, kind of like in spite of themselves. Like, they said that they were surprised that they enjoyed the speech and were as enthusiastic as they were, because they previously hadn't felt like they liked Trump very much. So that was an interesting conversion that took place for some of the delegates. I heard from another delegate who's a longtime Trump supporter who felt like what happened on Wednesday with Cruz really helped Trump on Thursday, that he felt like everybody was so angry at Cruz that it kind of coalesced. It allowed everyone to coalesce Trump and root for him instead. So he felt like all of the kind of negative energy and that happened when Cruz was booed off the stage on Wednesday, that he was happy to see that there wasn't any of that lingering on Thursday. And he thought actually the crowd was even more with Trump because of it. But I think also there were a number of delegates from our delegation that are still not convinced. I overheard a woman from our delegation talking with others about how she's still, isn't sure what she's going to do in November. She doesn't want to vote for Hillary, but she said, I just can't bring myself to vote for Trump.
A little bit before Donald Trump took the stage last night, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio spoke for about 5 minutes or so. What did he have to say, and how did the state's delegation react to it?
So I was able to be on the convention floor with the Arizona delegation when the sheriff took the stage, and the Arizona delegates jumped to their feet. They chanted, Joe, 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 and they were clapping for him. When the sheriff spoke, he talked about policing issues. He talked about trademark illegal immigration issues. He also talked about, he told a story, a personal story, about how moved he is by Trump as a candidate and as a person, because Trump has reached out to Sheriff Joe Arpaio's wife, Ava, who has cancer and has personally called her. She's a big Trump fan, and it meant a lot to the Arpaio family that he did that. So he shared that anecdote.
Jude, as you've reported during this week, Arpaio has been received as kind of a rock star in Cleveland, people taking pictures with him, asking to talk to him, asking for his autograph. Did you get the sense, even though you were with the Arizona delegation during his speech, did the rest of the convention really seem to be paying attention to what he was saying?
Well, one of the funny things about being at the convention is you realize that the audience is kind of distracted through a lot of the speeches. There's sort of a lot of milling around and chatting and taking of pictures even while the speeches are going. So, early in the evening, which is the slot the sheriff had, they're sort of a different dynamic than when you have the real keynote speeches. But he did get applause, and he made the rounds on TV national outlets afterwards. And it's a big contrast, though, for what he's coming back to today. He has a big hearing in federal court and was on a very early morning flight this morning. A lot of us from the Arizona delegation were on this one direct flight, and we'll be heading into court this afternoon, where he will be seeing Judge Murray Snow, and his lawyers will be arguing why he should not face criminal contempt of court.
Jude, as you say, Sheriff Arpaio is in federal court today, obviously a different stage from last night, going from the RNC to a courtroom. What are we expecting to hear from his attorneys and from other attorneys in this case?
So we're going to be hearing from four criminal defense lawyers. They each represent individuals who have been noticed as someone the judge is considering referring to a prosecutor for criminal contempt charges, and that includes Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan. So their lawyers are going to be making the argument that Criminal contempt is not necessary. In the case of Arpaio and Sheridan, the lawyers are arguing, look, the civil remedies that you ordered, Judge, earlier this week, that is sufficient to address the contempt issue. Criminal charges won't be necessary. So we'll be hearing those arguments this afternoon.
That was KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block, just back from the RNC in Cleveland. I spoke with her earlier today.
The highest-profile part of the final night of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland was reserved for presidential nominee Donald Trump's acceptance speech. But not long before Trump took to the podium, Silicon Valley investor Peter Thiel spoke. The openly gay Thiel talked a bit about his sexual orientation and received cheers. The last known gay person to address an RNC was former Arizona Congressman Jim Colby, who spoke in 2000. With me to talk about the GOP and LGBT issues and the reaction of attendees at the convention is Matthew Schumann, co-president of Arizona's Log Cabin Republicans. Based on last night's news and Peter Thiel's address, which did mention the fact that he is openly gay, and even when Donald Trump talked about, at least in some sense, being supportive of the LGBTQ community, what was your reaction to that? And did it seem like a big step to you?
You know, there are some people that are saying that the Republican Party platform for this year is the most anti-LGBT platform in the party's 162-year history. And then they are also saying that the speeches and addresses are the most pro-LGBT in the 162-year history of the party. So it's very interesting to have sort of both events going on at the same time.
When you're talking about a convention like this, for some voters, this is the first real chance they've had. They haven't been following the primary season a whole lot.
Right.
So for them to hear this, more of them are going to be familiar with the speeches than they are the platforms. Do you think that has an impact?
Oh, yes, absolutely it does. You know, the speeches are, you know, prime time. And the fact that, you know, Mr. Thiel had the ability to go on there, I think just two speeches before Mr. Trump's, was absolutely amazing. You know, nobody's really going to read the party platform that didn't, you know, include some horrible things. But yeah, they're going to be familiar with the speeches. That's what's going to be on YouTube. That's what's always going to be, you know, be viewed for the, you know, for the rest of, you know, time that's on YouTube.
I have to ask you, though, when you talk about the platform having some pretty horrible things in it, how do you reconcile that as someone who's co-president of the Log Cabin Republicans with your beliefs, knowing that in the actual party platform, there are some really lousy things said about people who are LGBT?
Certainly. Well, let's go ahead and acknowledge, no pun intended here, the elephant in the room. You know, in the party platform, they have an amendment talking about approving conversion therapy. That is absolutely just lunacy. And whoever proposed that is a very questioning person, in my opinion. You know, furthermore, in the platform, they also, you know, there was an amendment added by a friend of mine, Rachel Hoff, who I have to applaud, is the first openly gay person ever appointed to the platform. So she took the ability and, you know, submitted an amendment to approve gay marriage in the Republican Party platform. And it was voted down. And I was in that room and it was heartaching. But I think if you were to ask, you know, most gay Republicans or most log cabin Republicans how they reconcile being gay and a Republican, they're going to tell you that they're not a single issue voter. If I was going to vote purely on LGBT issues, I can understand some people may think that, you know, more likely that I'm going to vote Democrat. But the fact that I'm not a single issue voter and I care about several issues, that's typically how I reconcile it.
Basically, is the Arizona Republican Party, as you see it, more in line with what the party platform was or more of what we heard from speakers last night?
I'm going to say more in line with the speakers of last night. You know, you saw several members of the Arizona delegation last night applauding. You know, Governor Doug Ducey has LGBT people within his administration. That's just how it works. You know, as a gay Republican and somebody who has been involved in Republican politics for my whole life, I'm typically around powerful people, and they don't have an issue when I say, hey, you know, my boyfriend and I are doing this or whatever it is. And they've invited me to dinner. I see no issue with the people in the Arizona Republican Party, and I see them, just like I mentioned the young Republicans, going in that direction.
Matthew Schumann is co-president of Arizona Log Cabin Republicans. We've been reviewing some issues that happened during the Republican National Convention, including speeches last night by Peter Thiel and Donald Trump. And Matthew, great to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Imagine you're working on a telescope, which is deep in space, and it basically just stops working. That was the situation with NASA's Kepler telescope a few years back, but scientists were able to figure out how to use sunlight to get it back up and running. And this week, the team working on the K2 mission announced the telescope had spotted about 100 new planets. That's the biggest find since the mission started a couple of years ago. Astronomer Ian Crossfield is one of those on the team. He's a NASA Sagan Fellow at the University of Arizona. I spoke with him earlier on Skype and asked him what we know about these planets.
Mainly, we know two things about these planets. We know the size of them, and we know roughly how much starlight hits the top of the planet. So in principle, that latter point tells us something about the temperature on them too, but because we don't know anything about their atmospheres yet, it's tough to say too much what conditions might be like on the surfaces of any of these planets. One of the exciting things about the planets that we're finding with K2 is that although many other planets have been found in the past, the planets we're finding with K2 are significantly brighter than a lot of the stars we knew before. And because these planets are orbiting brighter stars, we're able to in much better detail study these planets with follow-up observations to study their atmospheres and learn just what they might be made of and how they might have formed.
How far away from us are these new planets?
They cover a wide range of distances, no particular distance. So from as close as 100 light years or maybe a bit closer out to many hundreds of light years.
So what has to happen in order to be able to study these more? I mean, is K2 able to do that, or do you have to send up another satellite and telescope to do that?
Well, K2 doesn't tell us too much more about them, but we also don't have to wait for new telescopes to go and do this. So we've already started observations with ground-based telescopes in Hawaii and in California to start to measure the masses of these planets. So then we'll know roughly, are they rocky or are they gas giants? And we've also started with a few of the best systems to look at them with the Hubble Space Telescope in orbit around Earth. And that's actually going to give us some of our first atmospheric measurements of what the atmospheres of these planets might be. But in just a couple of years, NASA will be launching the James Webb Space Telescope, sort of a bigger successor to Hubble. And that's going to be able to do an even better job at teasing out what these planets are made of.
Now, my understanding is that in addition to sort of the surprise of finding all these planets, it's a little bit surprising that K2 was actually able to do much of anything at all, right? There was sort of a mishap a few years back.
That's right. So originally the mission was called Kepler, and it was designed with a particular goal of measuring how frequently do Earth-sized planets occur around sun-like stars. And it did a great job in that mission for 4 years until a component of the spacecraft malfunctioned. Some clever engineers at Ball Aerospace were able to come up with a way to resuscitate the mission in this sort of broader survey mode that I described, a mission now called K2.
So the fact that they were able to figure out basically how to use sunlight to keep this telescope going, does that have any other applications, do you think, either in space or on Earth?
Probably not on Earth, but there could certainly be applications for it in space. It was a very clever way to save a useful space telescope and keep it productive.
So what does K2 do next? I mean, how long will it be up there?
So the results we presented with our 100 new planets just come from the first year or so of K2's data. And based on how much fuel it has left, NASA estimates that K2 will last at least 4 years, maybe a little bit longer. So we expect at least 4 times as many planets to be discovered by the end of the whole mission as what we've found already. And that's going to take us right up to the time when NASA's next exoplanet space satellite will be launching, called TESS, which will survey the entire sky, and so we'll find even larger numbers of planets around even brighter stars than K2 is doing.
On the list of things that scientists are hoping to find out about these new planets, could they sustain life and do they sustain life? Where is that on that list?
That's certainly always an interesting question at the back of many of our minds. I don't think we'll be able to answer it for any of the planets we discovered in this paper, discovered by K2. But by finding these new systems and by measuring how likely are different types of planets to occur around different types of stars, we're slowly starting to answer the question of how common are Earth-like, Earth-temperature planets. And that's one key ingredient of many in the formula of how common is life in the universe.
Ian Crossfield is an astronomer and a Sagan Fellow at the University of Arizona. We are talking about K2's discovery of 100 new planets. Ian, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. Here's a question. What TV show did entertainment powerhouse Lucille Ball save from cancellation?
That was not I Love Lucy.
The answer is Star Trek. This one is even better. Who convinced actress Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura in the original Star Trek, to stay with the show, even though she was the only African-American in the cast? That would be Martin Luther King Jr. Oh, yeah.
The stories will involve human beings in jeopardy. Sometimes me. I play Captain Kirk of the spaceship.
Many such galactic gems are to be found in a massive book, The 50-Year Mission, the complete uncensored, unauthorized oral history of Star Trek, the first 25 years. Actors, writers, producers, and just about anyone who's worked on this cult classic. Journalist Edward Gross is co-author of this authoritative tome and says that the little starship that could, that Lucy, of all people, saved, went on to save the universe.
They were a show that was struggling to stay on the air for all three seasons that it was on. It was threatened with cancellation in season one, threatened with cancellation in season two, and then fell apart in season three, even though they got their last season, which gave them enough episodes for syndication. So I don't think you could be in that environment and actively think, well, people don't appreciate it now, but someday they're going to appreciate this.
Is there a consensus in this group of what episode is the best or the one that captured what Star Trek was trying to say about the future?
Devil in the Dark was the episode with the Horta. And that's the,
right?
Now, everybody says, oh, the Horta, you know, and everyone goes to that as one of the classic episodes. But I think it's really symbolic of where we are as a society in the future, you know, in the sense of, here's this creature, it's killing people, it's wiping people out. But then we find out that the reason it's doing it is because what the miners are mining are its children, its eggs. So in the end, it's saying, this is an intelligent being. It's different from us, but it needs to survive. We're the ones who are the enemies. We're in its territory.
Tons of references to The City on the Edge of Forever.
The classic episode.
Which has Joan Collins.
Right.
I actually interviewed Joan Collins about being in that episode.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, she's so proud of it.
She should be.
Yeah.
It's a great episode. Harlan hates it.
Harlan Ellison,
the writer who wrote the original script, despises the episode.
Why does Spock call you captain? Were you in the war together?
We served together.
And you don't want to talk about it? Why? Did you do something wrong? Are you afraid of something?
And the reason he hates it is because, you know, at the end of the episode, Joan Collins is crossing the street, Edith Keeler is crossing the street, a truck is approaching. Now, Kirk has the choice. I save her or I let her die. And he ultimately chooses to throw himself into Bones, you know, McCoy's arms, and she dies. In Harlan's original story, he was willing to go and sacrifice everything for love, and Spock stopped him from doing so.
What's the real story on the relationship between the originals and the TNGs, the Next Generation?
Well, it was very interesting because when the show began, when Next Generation began, they were all against it. They came out very publicly against it, the actors. I mean, they were still making the movies. So I think they felt, and with good reason, I think, after all the years of people, you know, proclaiming them as gods of television, that they were Star Trek. And the idea of trying to do it with somebody else was insulting to them, and it would never work as far as they were concerned.
Yeah, right, because they were using real actors like Patrick Stewart as opposed to Shatner, who...
Hey, don't mess with the Shat. That's all I can tell you.
Did you spend a lot of time with Shatner?
I've spent some time... he's not a very talkative fellow. He's a funny guy in the sense of if you get him in a great mood, he does a great interview. If you get him in a bad mood, he does one-word answers. It's very, very interesting. Yeah.
My favorite of the movies... The Wrath of Khan movie is fantastic. Corrected all of the mistakes of the first movie.
Oh, absolutely. Because the first movie was trying to be something very different from what even the episodes were. It embraced the notion of going out in space and the notion of humanity taking the next step. It really embraced it and tried to deal with some serious ideas. It just did it in a slow manner.
The whale movie is fantastic.
The Voyage Home.
Voyage Home.
And it's very funny because a lot of people dismiss that one. It's really a good movie, and it really captures Star Trek.
Got great lines. I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
Who are you?
Who do you think I am?
Don't tell me. You're from outer space.
No, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
Great line.
Absolutely.
And yeah. When Chekhov goes, take us to the nuclear vessels.
The nuclear vessels.
The nuclear vessels. Take us. And he's asking cops this, and this is in the middle of the 80s, mm-hmm. at the height of the Reagan sort of Cold War period. So the idea that you would, that a Russian person would.
And they have that cop just staring at him.
Yeah.
When he's,
so
when he's,
good.
But you know what's so good about it is they have all the funny lines, but there's a moment between Shatner and Catherine Hicks.
Who plays the Iowa teacher.
Right. Well, the marine biologist.
Right, marine biologist, right. Exactly.
And they're in the Klingon ship, and they've turned the ship into a tank, and they're looking at the whales. And Shatner just delivers a line like, you know, it's ironic.
You know, it's ironic when man was killing these creatures, he was destroying his own future.
Now, that may not seem like much of a line, but that embodies Star Trek. Observing our modern behaviors and projecting it into the future.
What's the story with Roddenberry? They thank him in every movie. Is he a happy person? Is he someone who is abused by the studio? Is he a visionary? He certainly seems to have owned the rights to everything because he's got his name on everything.
Roddenberry is a visionary. He came up with Star Trek. He came up with the concept of Star Trek, and that alone allows him to, you know, warrants any sort of praise that wants to be thrown on him. The problem is that as good a visionary as he is, his writing didn't match his vision in the sense of he needed other people to help guide Star Trek. And he did. Like Gene L. Kuhn came in the middle of first season of the show. And if you look at the episodes, he was there for about a year. And if you look at the episodes, he really honed in on what Star Trek is, which takes nothing away from Roddenberry as the creator of Star Trek.
So let's end on Nimoy. It seemed when I saw the whale movie that he'd totally come around, that he basically had recognized that that was a thing to value and that his career really took off when he reintegrated Spock back into his life.
But the thing was, in the 70s, every one of those actors struggled. So you have these guys who can't break away from the image of Star Trek or the baggage of Star Trek, and yet need to work. They need to keep going forward. And Leonard Nimoy, if you look at that time period, he busted his butt. But then when they wanted to make the first movie, he had them in the position where, well, you're going to have to settle this with me or I'm not doing the movie. And yet the first movie was a miserable experience for him and everybody because it was just such a long process and the end result everybody hated at the time. Wrath of Khan, Harv Bennett, who took over from Roddenberry as producer, said, well, what if we kill Spock? What if we give you the opportunity to play your death scene? And Nimoy liked that. Not that he hated the character of Spock, but he figured, all right, I'll come back one more time and give him a dignified exit. So he came back, and he had such a good time that he came back. He said, I'll come back for three. I want to direct. And they said yes.
Edward Gross is the co-author of The 50-Year Mission, the complete, uncensored, unauthorized oral history of Star Trek the first 25 years.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
A professor at Arizona Western College in Yuma has caused a stir in the world of paleontology. His research suggests an ancestral porcupine evolved as a result of migration. From the Arizona Science Desk, Maya Springhawk Robinette reports for KJZZ that the debate over migration versus evolution has become rather prickly.
Fred Croxton has been a professor of geosciences at Arizona Western College in Yuma for 39 years, and he's built up a large fossil collection in that time, more than 12,000 specimens.
It's just more cluttered, but it's an organized clutter.
The fossils are housed in a small building on the edge of the college property, one which isn't even identified on campus maps. Croxton calls it the Lake Wobegon of Arizona Western College. It's here, but no one knows it exists. Croxton dedicates dozens of hours to single bones by use of air pressure tools to remove the matrix, or sand, surrounding them.
I don't know if you can hear my voice over the thing there, but you can see the matrix is just flaking off as I touch it.
Croxton and several colleagues have traveled into Sonora, Mexico for more than two decades. There, the El Golfo Badlands is home to a treasure trove of fossils that date back over a million years. That's where they found several ancient porcupine jaws. Croxton and his colleagues began to notice they were similar to the shape of the modern South American porcupine's jawbone, of the Coindu genus. That surprised them because another porcupine, the Arethusan genus of North America, is traditionally considered to be the closest relative of this ancient porcupine, the one found in El Golfo.
Our porcupines in North America, during the winter, they kind of slow down, but what's available to eat is not as luscious and diverse, so they have to scrape bark from trees. However, porcupines that live in the Neotropics, when they get up to eat, they have a year-round salad bar.
Croxon says the porcupine in North America had to develop a steeper-angled incisor as an evolutionary result of these eating habits. But established thought for this porcupine says evolution came first, then migration. If the porcupine jaws Croxon has don't have these incisors, how could they have evolved before migrating north from South America? That's why Croxon and four other geoscientists have collaborated on an article 15 years in the making. But the conclusion doesn't sit well with everyone in the paleontological community.
Well, what about all this other information? What about limb bones? What about skulls?
Gary Morgan is a curator of vertebrate paleontology at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History. Morgan says Croxon and the other authors have only looked at jaws.
Their sample that they're looking at is too limited, and it may not actually be diagnostic of the different porcupines when you look at a larger, broader sample than you're seeing that most of the features do look like this Arethusan.
Morgan says there's a large porcupine fossil collection in Florida from around the same time period. He believes when you look at the whole animal, these ancient porcupines seem more closely related to the modern North American porcupine than its South American cousin.
They think it's one animal, I think it's another, and I think I'm right only because they don't have any limb bones, they don't have any skulls, all these things that we have in the Florida sample that indicate that the animal belongs to this Arethusan genus, they lack that in the samples they're looking at.
Professor Croxon at Arizona Western College agrees to disagree, but that's okay with him.
We're more than happy to have any folks who wish to disagree with us and show us some other interpretations of our data. We'll find out. That's part of science.
The article and its controversy will be published in the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County's Contributions in Science on July 20th. For the Arizona Science Desk, I'm Maya Springhawk, RobNet.
Dramatic scenes at the border between Greece and Macedonia last summer marked a crunch point in the European refugee crisis. This year it's been much quieter, thanks to the official closure of the so-called Balkan route. But there are still hundreds of people stuck in Macedonia, caught out by the change of policy earlier this year. They've been housed in facilities originally designed to accommodate people who are only passing through. The BBC's Guy Delaney reports from one camp on the Macedonian side of the border with Serbia.
This is the outdoor canteen at the Tabanovce Transit Center for refugees, and people are just finishing their lunch here on a very hot afternoon. The temperature's pushing into the 30s Celsius, and they'll only go higher as the summer really comes on strong. And that's a problem because this place wasn't designed for a long-term stay. It was designed for people just coming through quickly and getting onto trains and resuming their journey along the so-called Balkan route.
They wanted to continue with their journey, but they are stuck up here. They're getting frustrated and they're getting depressed, and they're going through a very difficult psychological state of mind.
Mohamed Arif is the representative in Macedonia for the UN's refugee agency, the UNHCR.
There were about 1,400 here when the borders got closed, and the others have gone. You know, and when the restrictions are made tight, what happens is there are other avenues that they would look for. And those avenues could be very dangerous and very difficult ones, because if you don't have a system, what happens is that then the illegal ways come up and the smugglers' business are booming.
There's a mixture of residents here at Tabanovce, which you can clearly see as you walk around the camp. There are young men on their own. There are family groups. And there's even one newborn baby, just a matter of days old, who was born in a hospital just down the road in Kumanovo, and is now spending its first days at this transit camp. Lots of families have already left, says Simin Afshar. She's come from Afghanistan with her three children and now newborn Matis. She says she's out of money, but wouldn't pay people smugglers even if that were an option.
I would not take that risk with my three daughters. Even if I had the money, I couldn't trust anyone.
One of those daughters, 12-year-old Samira, says she misses school, but she's also seen enough danger to know she's safer here than she was in her hometown of Herat.
In Afghanistan, we did not feel secure. There was fighting every day there. Here we feel safe. At least we can walk around without fear. But in Afghanistan, we could not walk to the end of the street. It was full of risks.
Construction workers are busy making Tabanovse more suitable for longer-term housing. But while some residents are resigned to waiting, those who have money continue to seek out the often callous people smugglers. Human rights lawyer Arben Gudaci advises people at the camp. He says it's a case of desperate people taking considerable risks.
Especially after the border were closed 2 months ago, we can see that they are more vulnerable because they have to go through smugglers through very bad ways. I mean, they go through mountains and they walk several days. And most of them, we had an interview with a lot of refugees that were attacked from the population or from smugglers, etc. They were robbed, their phone were robbed as well, they were beaten, etc.
The summer of 2015 saw tumultuous scenes in Macedonia. While they may not be repeated, there's still a hidden story on the Balkan route, with thousands of people desperate to reach Western Europe. Some of them are on the move, some of them stuck in camps like Tabanovse, but all of them are determined to get somewhere better.
That's the BBC's Guy Delaney.
The State Transportation Department says it plans to widen two of the three stretches of I-10 between Phoenix and Tucson that are still two lanes. They'll be widened to three lanes in each direction. The work will be done with a combination of state and federal money. The widening is good news for Tony Bradley. He's the president and CEO of the Arizona Trucking Association. And Tony, I would imagine you and your members are pretty excited about more travel lanes on I-10.
Sure. We're very excited. The movement of freight is critically important to not only Arizona's economy, but the U.S. economy. There are three stretches of I-10 between Tucson and Phoenix that narrow back down to two lanes. And that can become frustrating, one, when you're trying to deliver freight, two, when you're trying to deliver freight on time, and three, when you've got a lot of traffic. And so this widening project will address two of those three spots, which is critically important to Arizona as we try and move people and freight back and forth from Arizona to the Nogales border, where we're getting stuff from Mexico, agriculture products, bringing it to Phoenix for redistribution to Texas, LA, around the country.
How much of an impact do you think this widening will have? I mean, how much more freight, how much more on time do you think some of these shipments will be?
You know, it's all about predictability in our industry. People can predict when things are going to arrive and then adjust their schedules and adjust their inventories as necessary. So it's more about predictability and looking forward.
Would you imagine that having an extra lane on these stretches of I-10 will help with development along the freeway as well, in addition to just your members, for example, having a better route between the two cities?
You know, we already see development going on during these segments. We've got Phoenix Mart is a big concept that's coming to Casa Grande that'll benefit from these stretches being widened. We've got the Port of Tucson, which is a railroad intermodal facility in Tucson. So this expansion really will help our economy. It'll help those segments of towns and cities between Tucson and Phoenix as they grow their economies. And these are towns that were boom towns at one point along that old roadway, you know, and they've kind of died off. And now I think we can see them coming back a little bit.
Do you think that this will make Arizona more competitive in terms of companies, manufacturers will look at this and say, okay, well, I don't have to worry about an accident closing I-10 between Phoenix and Tucson anymore because there's an extra lane there. So there's a better chance of us being able to get where we need to go. So I'm not so worried about sending something through Arizona now as opposed to maybe entering the U.S. through Texas, for example.
Arizona is already a great place to do business. You talk about California, and what's the one thing everybody hates? Traffic. And so if we can eliminate the traffic bottleneck that could come up between Tucson and Phoenix, it increases our attractability for those businesses. So I think, you know, knowing that I-10 will be wider, that there's not going to be backup as those regions do grow, makes us incredibly competitive.
With these projects, where will that put Arizona as far as competing with some of our neighbors? You mentioned California's traffic, but will Arizona's freeways be better than other states' freeways? Will it sort of bring us up to standard?
Everybody's behind. The reality is we as a state, even with this investment, there's an Auditor General's report that shows we're $64 billion short of what our growth needs are and what we're losing because of inflation by the year 2035. So this is just a drop in the bucket, but it's a start. So we're happy to get, even though it's a pittance, you know, we're happy to get some momentum going in what the governor's office and what the transportation director, John Halachowski, calls the key commerce corridors. We know that if we focus on these key commerce corridors, that will help Arizona's economy grow, which will allow us to get more money to spend into transportation, which will allow us to grow and put more money into transportation. So it's this exponential factor. So that's why this is exciting, is that for years we've been fighting for every little dime we can get. And don't get me wrong, we're still fighting for it. But there was an incentive from the federal government when they passed their bill to say, if you're going to do these types of projects, we're going to incentivize you to do that. And I think Arizona's in a great space because we're a growing state. Other states, when they're looking at projects like this, they're looking at maintenance. We're looking at expanding our roads because our population's still growing. And we've got some old two-lane roads that we can expand to three lanes and get a lot more bang for our buck for it.
Tony Bradley is president and CEO of the Arizona Trucking Association. Tony, thanks.
Thank you.
We may soon be seeing agaves and their byproducts in places besides the desert and shot glasses. Ford Motor Company is working with Jose Cuervo, the tequila maker, to take agave fibers left from the juice extraction process and incorporate them into the plastic to be used in car parts. Debbie Molesky is Senior Technical Leader for Sustainable Materials Research at Ford. And Debbie, what is it about these fibers that you think will make them good to use in your cars?
The fibers are tough. They have pleasing aesthetics, so they look beautiful in the plastic material. They turn the plastic like a caramel color. And so we think that they are a good replacement for very dense materials that we currently reinforce plastics with, that being glass and talc. Both of those are high energy materials and very, very heavy. And so this fiber is very lightweight.
Does that improve the performance of the part or the car itself, in addition to maybe being better for the environment and maybe looking a little better?
Yeah, so we are meeting all the requirements for mechanical properties, durability properties for the parts that we're currently isolating or looking at. And the whole idea is every bit of weight will contribute to better fuel economy.
So when you get these fibers, what do they look like when you're mixing them in with the plastics?
They look like a really tough piece of rope. Of course, it's not woven into a rope, but maybe the material that rope is made out of. And so we chop it into about 3-millimeter pieces so that we can get it through our extrusion and injection molding into the shape of the part. The parts have a really natural look, and I think thus far people really like or prefer the way they look as compared to just plain old black plastic.
What kinds of parts are you using this for? I mean, are these things that people, obviously, they can see them if you're getting feedback on them?
Yeah, so we're looking at them in the lab and having people make assessments in our design functions. But we're looking also at wiring harness. We're looking at HVAC units, storage bins, places where we currently use those heavy, dense fillers and where we can lightweight using this fiber, but also trim in the car where you would actually see it. Where they have the wood trim now, there may be a day where we see agave trim.
What do you think is the ultimate potential of agave fibers? I mean, what's the ceiling, do you think, for your use of these?
We think that there's lots of potential for automobiles, for the applications that I suggested, but the hope is once we develop the industry and these materials can replace a lot of the common household good, plastic materials, office furniture, the baby seat industry, toys. So our hope is really to lower our environmental impacts, but to help others and to create plastics that can be used year after year in many industries.
What is the timeline in your mind? I mean, when could cars be on the road that have agave fibers sort of built into them?
It's really hard to say because the supply chain is one of the big challenges. We have to find people who believe enough to invest in compounding and making pellets and selling those pellets for molding, and then we would put it into our cars. So there's many parts of the supply chain that are still missing, but I can give you an example. For wheat straw in Canada, it took us about 18 months from conception of the idea to putting it on cars. For soy foam, it took us 4 to 5 years.
And how long have you been working with the agave fibers?
We have been working about a year, but our first shipment of the actual fiber was about 9 months ago.
From an optics perspective, do you see any challenges with a car maker working with an alcohol company?
No. I mean, I think we are working with so many different companies who have these side streams that are currently burned. And for us to ignore the fact that this really isn't a waste product, it could be a usable thing. And when you burn things, you're creating more CO2 and you don't even get any value from it, I think is a shame. So this partnership is about that leftover. And we're really focused on farm to car instead of like people are getting used to eating farm to table.
Debbie Molesky is Senior Technical Leader for Sustainable Materials Research at the Ford Motor Company. Debbie, thanks.
Thank you.
Veterans returning home face new challenges when they get back, hassle with health care and benefits, adjusting to a new routine. For the last century, groups like the American Legion and Veterans of Foreign Wars have helped vets with their needs and gave them a place to feel comfortable.
Membership in these groups has been dropping, though, as elderly members pass away and younger veterans choose not to join. The show's Annika Klein has more on what veterans are looking for today.
When you join Team Red, White, and Blue, you join a group that bowls, barbecues, and bikes together. And that's just 1 month of events. The national organization was created in 2010 with the mission to improve veterans' lives through social and physical activity. Today, the Phoenix chapter has a tent set up at the Tempe Adventure Run.
I noticed it right away as soon as you...
Ricardo Renteria is proudly supporting his Team RWB shirt.
As an amputee, I feel singled out sometimes when I see some of these activities.
Not so when he runs with RWB.
When I see someone else with an amputation, I feel better. Like, all right, I'm not the only one here. And then when I find out that they're a service member, oh, man, that makes my day right there.
The energized events the team plans around town are different than what you'd find if you walk into an American Legion or a Veterans of Foreign Wars post.
We've tried everything to get them to come here, and nothing seems to be working.
Pat Tyson sits with his wife, Mary, at VFW Post 720 in Phoenix. It's been around for about 90 years. The Tysons are regulars, enjoying a drink here once or twice a week.
The reason we come here is we feel a little bit safer than going to the local bar.
Here it's more relaxed, and they feel at home, chatting with the other members and the bartender. But they're part of a shrinking group. VFW membership has been slipping since its peak in the early 90s.
They're coming to be a thing of the past because there's no new members.
Tyson says sometimes he'll see a younger vet walk into the post, but they don't often become regulars. For Juan Jimenez, the captain of RWB in Phoenix, hanging out at a VFW post just wasn't the right fit.
I am a Desert Storm, Desert Shield veteran.
When he finished his service in 1992, he was looking for a way to connect with other veterans because he didn't connect with his peers.
Here I am, a 24-year-old veteran freshman, where the rest of my classmates were 17, 18-year-olds.
School administrators gave Jimenez the address for the nearest Veterans of Foreign Wars post.
But it wasn't the thing that I was looking for. It seemed to me that everybody smoked, everybody drank. Just that scene was kind of depressing to me.
While the bar might be where veterans come together, the mission of the VFW is to support veterans with things like finances and health care and to lobby for them in Congress. They rely on membership dues to help pay for those services. And when veterans like Jimenez decide it's not for them, that budget drops. The American Legion is having the same problem. It also hit peak membership in the early 90s, dropping by about 1 million members since.
It all goes back to recruitment.
That's Ben Carrillo with the American Legion's Arizona Department. He says they're focusing on turning their younger members into recruitment leaders so they can bring in more young vets.
Because they don't know what benefits and rights they have. And when they don't know what benefits and rights they have, especially now when they come back with all these injuries and they're not being compensated for them, then it sparks an interest.
For this reason, he thinks veterans from his age group and younger will join eventually. Just like it took a little while for Vietnam veterans to come around, a 1971 Wall Street Journal article painted this same dismal picture of the Legion fading away. It talks about a Legion struggling to appeal to young Vietnam veterans because it's, quote, not their thing. But today, Vietnam and Vietnam-era vets number more than 1 million members nationally.
I don't see American Legion falling.
It's possible the Legion and VFW will see another boost in the future. It's not like you can't be a member of the old and the new. Ricardo Renteria, the RWB member you heard from earlier, is actually a member of all three.
I'll take care of the administrative type of duties there, and then after I eat a lot at those meetings, I come to these activities here and I run.
He says he thinks the military does not do a good job helping vets transition back to civilian life. So he's worried about the vets who don't join any group.
I'm very concerned because those are the veterans that start to fall into depression. Life starts to go downhill for them because they don't want to be a part of anything.
Fighting that isolation is where the missions of groups like the VFW and groups like Team RWB converge.
Yeah, at the end, it's all about being with the community, with people you're familiar with.
For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
The Arizona Diamondbacks have been one of baseball's biggest disappointments this season. After a series of off-season trades and signings, the team was expected to contend, but so far in 2016, just about everything that can go wrong has, with home fans bearing the brunt of the losing. KJZZ's Phil Latzman went out to the ballgame this week to find out how fans and players are navigating through a difficult season. Phil, you saw an interleague game earlier this week?
I did, Steve. It was a Wednesday matinee in front of a sparse crowd at Chase Field. The last place Diamondbacks finished up a homestand against the Toronto Blue Jays. Barely 2 minutes into the game, a home run rockets into the park's signature swimming pool in right center field. The cheers you hear aren't coming from the home fans. They're coming from the fans of the visiting Blue Jays, as Toronto slugger Josh Donaldson's opposite field splash puts them ahead 2-0. The short sequence represents the Diamondbacks' season in microcosm. Arizona goes on to lose 10-4, its 35th loss in 52 home games this season.
It's frustrating. You want to see the team win. You want to see a little bit of home dominance.
That's Dwayne DePhillips taking in the festivities with his 15-year-old daughter, Alicia, who quickly diagnoses the D-backs' biggest problem.
They're doing okay. Their pitching's kind of off.
Win or lose, Terrell Shaleen is here with his 5-year-old son, simply for the love of the game.
No, they're not winning a lot at home, but you're a true fan. I grew up in the Valley. I'm a fan of all the home teams. You just kind of stick with it.
But many fans haven't been as faithful. The D-backs sent record lows for attendance earlier this season, and as they sink deeper in the standings, so do their prospects of attracting more fans like the Shaleens.
We've got fickle fans here, unfortunately. Once the D-backs turn around, attendance will go up for them. There'll be a lot more home team fans. That'll be the key, so unfortunately.
I think there were a lot of high expectations around here. I think everybody figured that they would be, you know, if not a playoff team, certainly a team that was in the hunt until late in the year.
That's Nick Pecoro. He's covered the Diamondbacks for the Arizona Republic for the past 8 seasons and is also a Valley native. He says the trouble has also been off the field. The team's front office generated bad publicity with their stated desire to get out of the lease at Chase Field earlier this year.
They've had a lot of things go poorly. I mean, I think that the stadium stuff at the beginning of the season was a bit of a black eye for these guys.
Pecoro also believes Diamondbacks management is guilty of overbilling a team that wasn't ready to compete. The sports writer doesn't blame fans for giving up on the team.
You know, you look back through the history of this organization, they've had a lot of trouble sustaining success. They had a lot of success early on, and then it's kind of just been a real roller coaster ride from year to year.
The disappointment is palpable in the players' clubhouse.
I think it's been frustrating for a lot of people, especially all the promise that looked like coming out of spring training. Everything was clicking there, and that was a glimpse of what we thought we would have this season.
That's veteran relief pitcher Josh Colemanter, and that promise was due to offseason moves that yielded starting pitchers Zach Greinke and Shelby Miller. Greinke, who signed a $206 million free agent deal with Arizona, has lived up to his billing as one of the game's best pitchers, but he's been out nearly a month with an oblique injury. Miller has been a total bust. Acquired in the offseason for two top prospects and outfielder Ender Inciarte, he recently was sent down to the minors after starting the season with a 2-9 record.
You need both sides of the ball to line up, pitching and hitting, and it seems like anytime the pitching's going well, we haven't scored runs and vice versa. And, you know, it's not for a lack of trying or effort or talent in this room. It just hasn't quite worked out for us like we thought it would.
Fellow veteran reliever Daniel Hudson says he knows it hasn't been easy for D-backs faithful to endure
or afford.
You know, it's tough for people to justify spending their hard-earned money on tickets to come watch us play when we're not playing well. And, you know, it's totally understandable. And hopefully, you know, the fans that do come out here the next, you know, 2.5 months, you know that these guys are really trying our best out there to win ball games.
Well, Steve, the good news for the Diamondbacks is actually they have a winning record on the road this season, where they'll be for the next week and a half.
Phil, you covered sports for a long time, including a team in Miami that sort of went from last to first and first to last. You've spent a lot of time at baseball games. Who's to blame for the Diamondbacks' problems?
You know, certainly the architects, the chief baseball officer, Tony La Russa, general manager, Dave Stewart, for miscalculating, making trades that may have given up too much for too little. But I don't think there are bad intentions. When I covered the Marlins in Miami, you got the sense that the ownership wasn't quite as committed to winning as what you have here. I've been around organizations where winning isn't important, and I think here it's just poor judgment and not bad intentions.
KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Phil, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.